toggling light off. It would go into a passive listening state, and someone would have to know where to look for it to register as more than a grain of sand floating in the unimaginably vast ocean of the void. Going dark was the right thing to do, but she rebelled at it. "What's the point," she said, "of having something you can't use? Functionally, it's the same as not having it." On her screen, the loop ended and began again, the tempest rising up from the gate. "Preserving something to use at the right time isn't nothing, Sasaki," Vaughn said. "Was being rhetorical," Drummer said. "Apologies," Vaughn said. "Tell them..." It was more than her window into Medina. It was her link to Saba. What if he needed to reach her? What if something happened and his call for help died in silence because she was being too careful? Loneliness widened in her chest, stretched until it felt bigger than she was, emptier. "Tell them to shut it down. Save it for a rainy day." "Yes, ma'am," Vaughn said, and turned to leave. "Have you ever seen rain, Vaughn?" she said, stopping him. Giving herself a few more seconds with the connection to Medina and Saba still there, even if she couldn't use it. "No, ma'am. Never been to Earth. Never planned to." "Rainy day, though. We still say it. Inner planet cultural imperialism is in everything," Vaughn said. "Rain isn't just for inners. It rains on Titan, too. It's methane instead of water, but you can see it if you're in the domes there. I spent my Madhu Chandra week there. A billion dots on the surface of the dome with the orange clouds behind it. They look like tiny dark stars. If you can see them. Saba's distance vision isn't good. He couldn't see them, but I could." "If you say so, ma'am," Vaughn said. Either he was mildly embarrassed for her, or she imagined he was. "Well, fuck you too," she thought, but didn't say it in case it was just her. "All right," she said, turning back to her screen. "Send the order." Vaughn didn't answer, just walked out and closed the door behind him. She watched the tempest pass through the ring gate one last time, looking for a clue in it, or a ray of hope. She didn't see one, and she closed the recording down and opened the other one. "This is Admiral Anton Trejo of the Laconian Imperial Navy and High Commander of the Heart of the Tempest. I am presently on a mission to secure Laconian interests in Sol System. We recognize the deep cultural and historical importance of Sol System and hope that this transition can be made peacefully and with a minimum of disruption. In the event that local forces resist, I am prepared and authorized to take any actions necessary to complete my mission. High Consul Duarte and I extend our best wishes to the local residents and ask that you contact your governments to urge them to act in the name of peace. Violence is always a loss, and the measure of that loss is entirely in your control." The false gentility of the threat made her wish he'd just said he'd burn their cities and take their children. It would have felt more honest. People's Home was on its breaking burn to meet with the EMC's second fleet, where Guard of Passage already waited. Independence was already with the first fleet and Jupiter. The newest void city, Assurance of Peace, was half-built at the Palace Tycho shipyards and wouldn't be ready for another year, assuming that they had another year. The unspoken truth was that the Union had commissioned the void cities as a permanent response to the colony world's interest in building their own fleets. A void city couldn't control a whole solar system, but it could command a ring gate. Or that's what Drummer and the Union board had assumed. Now, People's Home was only a battleship, a massive one with greenhouses and schools, children and common space, universities and research labs. But the prospect of violence meant that none of that mattered. People's home was a delivery system for railguns, missiles, PDCs, and she would drive it down to protect Earth and Mars and be protected by their ships. She'd hate everything about it, but she'd do it. And God damn it, she'd have to smile while she did. The underburn configuration of People's Home put the meeting rooms down near the massive array of Epstein drives. The EMC was represented by Admiral Hu of Mars and Undersecretary of Executive Affairs Vanegas. Christian Avasarala sat in a wheelchair at the back of the hall, eating pistachios and pretending to be dotty so that people left her alone. The lights had been set to a warm cut of the spectrum that was alleged to match a summer afternoon on Earth, and the air smelled of cut cucumber and soil. A reassuring environment that would hopefully affect the tone of the event, even if it was all engineering. The reporters and dignitaries on the formed bamboo benches all wore formal suits and dresses, as if a press conference were the same as going to church. Maybe it was. Drummer had read somewhere that news feeds were where secular societies went to find out what cultural narratives were important and what could be ignored. There were thousands of feeds streaming right now, all around the system, with every variation of the ways to make sense of the history they were living through. In most, Laconia was an invading force to be resisted. But there were people who said Laconia was a liberating influence, an end to the oppression of the EMC and the Transport Union, or that they were the true spirit of Mars, betrayed by the old Congressional Republic and now returned in triumph, or that they were unbeatable and capitulation was the only choice. Put a dozen people in front of the cameras and you'd wind up with 13 opinions. None of them would matter as much as hers, because she was the president of the Transport Union, and that, despite all her intentions and efforts, meant she was a war leader now. In the green room, Vanegas was getting his makeup freshened before they went out to the cameras. Hu put down her coffee as soon as Drummer stepped into the room and hurried over to her, a grim expression on her face. "President Drummer," Hu said, "I was hoping I could speak with you about the board's strategic cooperation documents." A steward led Drummer to a chair. A technician swung in beside her with a pallet of cosmetics in his hand. She didn't have much use for makeup, but she didn't want to look sickly in the feeds either. "I haven't seen the new draft yet," Drummer said, trying not to move her face. "Santos Baca is insisting on the chain of command passing through a joint committee," Hu said. "That's not coordination. That's making the EMC a branch of the Transport Union." "If they kill us all," Drummer thought, "this will be why. Not their technology, not their strategy, not the invisible cycle of history. It'll be our inability to do anything without 5 committee meetings to talk about it." "I haven't read the draft, Admiral. As soon as we're done here, I'll have them get me a copy. I don't want to get this muddy any more than you do." Hu nodded sharply and smiled as if Drummer had capitulated. The technician touched her cheeks with a rouge brush and considered her like she was a painting. She had to fight the impulse to stick her tongue out at him. And then it was time. Vanegas walked out first, and then Hu. They took the podiums to either side. Drummer took the center. The podium screen threw up an image visible only to her, running through the lines of the speech. She lifted her chin. It didn't matter how she felt. It didn't matter what she thought. All that counted right now was how she looked and sounded. Let those carry confidence, and she could find the real thing later. "Thank you all for coming," Drummer said. "As you know, A ship originating in Laconia's system has now made an unauthorized transit into Sol's system. The Union stance is unequivocal on this matter. The Laconian incursion is illegal. It is a violation of the Union's authority and the sovereignty of the Earth-Mars Coalition. We stand as one body in defense of the Sol system and all its citizens. Drummer paused. In the back of the group, Christiane Avasarala stood up from her wheelchair and dusted the pistachio bits off her sari. Her smile was visible, even from here. "And the Union," Drummer said, "will dedicate all its resources to the defense effort." "Just like you told us to, you old bitch," she thought. She didn't say it. In her dream, Saba was dead. She didn't know how he died or where, and with the non-logic of sleep, she didn't question that. It was simply the truth. Saba was dead, and she wasn't. She'd never see him again. She wouldn't wake up beside him. The rest of her life was emptier and smaller and sadder because of it. In the dream, she knew all of that. But what she felt was relief. Saba was dead, and so he was safe now. Nothing bad could happen to him anymore. She couldn't fail him, or abandon him, or feel the weight of his disappointment. She woke into darkness, a moment's confusion, and then a wave of overwhelming guilt. The darkness, at least, she could control. She moved the cabin lights up a quarter. Dim gold, faint enough to leave everything in monochrome. She could feel the thrust gravity when she turned, the absence of even trace Coriolis telling her what she already knew. She wanted to send a message out, to tell Saba she was thinking of him, and not quietly longing for the failures that would lose him forever. But she'd cut that line of communication, and having a weird subconscious wasn't a good reason to change that policy. Instead, she stretched in the near dark. Only half of her sleep cycle was done, but she wasn't interested in diving back into the pillow. Instead, she showered and ordered up a bulb of tea and a tortilla with fruit jam. Comfort food. Then she checked the system map. The Tempest was still out in the vastness between the orbits of Uranus and Saturn. 1.5 kilometers between the Ring Gate and the first human habitats of any real size, even if Saturn and its moons were at their closest. Having come through the gate so much earlier than she'd hoped, the Tempest wasn't burning hard for the inner solar system. At its present acceleration, it would take weeks to reach her. Drummer pulled on her uniform and went out into people's home. The tube station was near her quarters. The Void City knew where she was, and arranged a private car for her without her even having to ask for it. Her security detail shadowed her with the practice of years. Even at the height of a shift change, she moved through the city like it was a ghost town. Only the litter and smell of bodies and old curry in the tube lingered as a promise that she wasn't as alone as she felt. The Arboretum was a restricted access zone. Some of the trees were experimental, and being in a high traffic area would have affected the data. But one person, or a handful, that was within tolerance. It was warm there, the air thick with moisture and the novelty of oxygen that had just been breathed out by another living thing. It was a strange place, exotic and surreal, like something out of a child's fantasy. Usually she was the only one there. Avasarala sat in the shade of a catalpa. Her hands were folded in her lap. Her eyes were unfocused until Drummer stepped onto the black rubber walkway in front of her. "The fuck are you doing here?" the old woman said. "Don't you sleep?" "I could ask you the same," Drummer said. I don't sleep anymore. It's one of the things you lose at my age. I'm not incontinent yet, though, so I don't get to bitch. Drummer leaned against one of the trees, folded her arms. She didn't know if she was pleased the old woman was there, or annoyed by her, or both. "Is there a reason you're still on People's Home?" she asked, but her voice wasn't biting. "Thought I might need to firm up your resolve, but I didn't. Now I'm only here because I hate fucking space travel. You're going my way. I'll get out when the last leg of the trip home is shorter." "So, not just looking to stick your nose in my business?"
"Not until you fuck up," Avasala said. "Sit down, Kamina. You look exhausted."
"No one calls me that, you know," Drummer said. But she sat on the bench at Avasarla's side.
"Almost no one."
They sat for a moment with only the sound of dripping water and the tapping of leaves that moved in the artificially controlled breeze. The wisps of her dream haunted Drummer's mind like the afterimage of a strobe.
"One ship," she said. "They sent one ship. They didn't hold ground at Medina. They didn't fortify. They didn't build supply lines or prepare a flotilla. They sent one big-ass ship through by itself, like a boast."
"I'm as surprised as you are," Avasarala said, "though I feel I shouldn't be. I actually read history. It's like reading prophecy, you know. All we have to do is deal with this one ship, and everyone will see that Duarte's not invulnerable. He's not infallible."
"That's true."
Drummer laced her fingers, leaned forward with her elbows on her knees. "All we need is one lucky break," she said. "One thing to go our way, and your logistical mastermind, who would never overreach, loses his capital ship in front of everyone who's watching. And I think everyone is watching."
"They are,"
Avasarala agreed with a sigh. But what? Avasarala's smile was thin, hard and bitter. Her eyes flashed with an intelligence poisoned by despair.
"But it isn't hubris until he's failed."
Chapter 24. Sing. Sing's monitor lay flattened on the desk in front of him. Above it floated a 3D projection of Natalia and Elsa smiling back at him. It wasn't a great shot of them. He'd photographed it himself, and it was a little out of focus. But it was taken at the park where they'd had the monster's second birthday party, and his daughter grinned out at him with cheeks covered in vanilla frosting, and Nat positively glowed with happiness. It was one of his favorite memories. "Once the typhoon arrives, I will be able to move to the important work. It also almost certainly means this posting at Medina will be made permanent soon. I want you to start thinking about relocation. Your work was always about helping the colony worlds establish stable food sources, and this is the hub of everything. They'll welcome your research here with open arms, and I promise the water issue should be fixed by the time you and Monster would arrive. Nothing but clean water for you guys, or I'll tear the station down one bolt at a time and rebuild it myself. I also..."
"Governor,"
a voice said from the monitor, startling him.
"Yes?
Major Overstreet is here. He says it's an emergency."
"All right,"
Sing replied, then shut down the image and saved his letter to finish later.
"Send him in."
Overstreet was almost the physical opposite of his predecessor. Where Colonel Tanaka was tall, almost to the point of rangy, he was short, thick-necked and broad, with fists the size of boxing gloves. His shaved head was the palest skin Singh had ever seen, and his eyes were an icy blue. Among Martians,
That combination was fairly exotic.
"Governor," Overstreet said with a sharp salute.
"At ease, Major."
Overstreet shifted his feet apart and linked his hands behind his back. Where Tanaka had been all arrogant insouciance, Overstreet was every bit the disciplined Marine. Singh liked working with him.
"Governor, I'm sorry to report another terrorist incident. Unfortunately, this one also included a loss of life."
Loss of life only meant one thing in this context, a Laconian fatality.
"Thank you for keeping it off the wire, Major," Singh said. Following the assassination attempt, he'd ordered that any further terrorist activity be kept as quiet as possible. They needed the population of Medina to feel like they were safe under Laconian control.
"Who and where?"
"Second Lieutenant Imari, an environmental support specialist. She was tracking an air filtration error and wound up in a crawl space on the outermost level of the drum. A small, improvised explosive device was remotely detonated. Lieutenant Imari was killed instantly. One of her techs received minor injuries and is being treated on the storm."
"Imari," Singh said, concentrating until he could place a face with the name. He'd only met her a few times, pleasant and professional in all their interactions, and her skills with environmental systems would be sorely missed in Medina's refit.
"Do we know who?"
"I had bomb techs on the site within minutes of the blast," Overstreet said. "The chemicals used to manufacture the explosive were traced to a storage compartment on drum level 2. I pulled the logs. The majority of those with access have been identified. Marines have already begun rounding them up."
"That is excellent work, Major," Singh said. Overstreet brought him a solution with every problem, he reported. It made his own terrible misstep with Tanaka feel like a blessing in disguise.
"The rules of engagement allow us to treat active terror cells as enemy combatants," Overstreet said. "But unless one of these idiots has a hideaway gun, I'm betting we'll bring them all in alive. So it's your call, sir."
Overstreet looked like he had no opinion one way or the other. If Singh ordered him to go to the holding pens and shoot every single person in the head, it would be just the next thing he did that day. No lectures on how he'd fought belter cells back in the day, no subtle digs at his lack of experience.
"We're going to need to start holding trials at some point," Singh said. "This seems as good a time as any.
We'll need some time to form a civilian justice system for Medina and the colonies, something less encumbered than the local habits."
"Yes, sir," Overstreet agreed with a nod. "I'll have my people put together all the evidence we've collected and forward it to the advocate's office. We're not police, but whatever we can do to expedite the trial process, we're happy to help out."
Singh leaned back and pointed at one of the visitor chairs next to his desk.
"You're doing outstanding work, Major. You've slid into Colonel Tanaka's role without a hiccup. I appreciate it."
Overstreet stretched out, relaxing but without the aggressive informality of his predecessor.
"Tanaka was a great mentor. She left me detailed files on the duties of this post. Give her credit for the smooth transition."
"Mm-hmm," Singh said.
"Anyway, I've sent in my recommendation that you be promoted to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, as befits the posting you now hold. We're just waiting on word from Laconia to make it official. You've certainly got the years in, and your record is exemplary. I don't foresee any difficulty."
"I appreciate that, sir."
Overstreet started, then looked down at the monitor on his wrist.
"That's fast work. The detachment reports that all 7 of the suspects have already been rounded up and taken to a holding area awaiting your orders."
"Shall I have them taken to the open-air cells pending trial? Let everyone on the station see them locked up? Sends a message."
"Yes, I," Singh began, then rethought it.
"No. If that holding area is private, keep them there. I'd like to speak to them."
"Of course," Overstreet said.
Into his monitor, he said,
Trip Hammer, Oscar Mike, we need transport and escort to Level 4, Compartment 1311 Echo Bravo. Ready to move in 5. Singh had studied detailed files on the history of Medina. From its aspirational beginnings with an Earther religious faction, to its outright theft by the OPA and conversion into the universe's worst battleship, before finally settling in as the hub of human expansion through the gate network. Singh found the idea of a generation ship fascinating, in a morbid sort of way. He could understand taking great risks for your children. He was doing that right now, trying to help build the well-regulated human empire that his monster Elsa and her future children could thrive in. There was a romance in the idea of setting out on a journey you'd never see the end of, so that your grandchildren might live a better life. But all the numbers he'd seen on how a 100-year voyage like that would play out were fairly horrifying. It was, to say the least, a very high cost and a very low probability of success. Singh assumed there was a faith element to the risk that he was just missing. In his opinion, faith was generally for people who were bad at math. Compartment 1311EB turned out to be a former storage compartment for animal feed. Another of the many structures built into Medina Station back when it had been the Nauvoo and had interstellar colonization as its purpose. Medina was filled with these relics of the station's original purpose, even as they had been converted over to new uses. 7 Belters sat on the floor, hands zip-tied behind their backs. 4 men, 2 women, and 1 person who could be any gender or none, and who looked far too young to already have decided on a career in terrorism. Singh entered the room, flanked by 2 Marines in power armor, and Overstreet taking up a position by the door. The 4 Marine guards in the room snapped him a salute, then went back to watching their little gang of prisoners. With 15 bodies in the room, it felt very cramped. "I am the station governor, Captain Santiago Singh," he said, taking time to stare each of the 7 prisoners in the eye as he spoke. The youngest stared back with a fierce rage that looked entirely out of place on their beautiful, genderless face. "No one fucking cares," one of the men spat back at him. The Marine closest to him casually kicked him in the ribs. Singh waved him back. "I'll need you all to listen to me very carefully," he said. "A bomb was made using chemicals from the warehouse you 7 work in. That bomb killed a Laconian naval officer and injured another." "Good," said one of the women. "Not good," Singh replied, without changing his tone, "because the penalty for this criminal act will be death by firing squad. At this point, there is no reason to believe all 7 of you aren't in collusion. You are either working with terrorist cells, or you are in fact the cell that planted that bomb. Better to die a free Belter than live a slave," the young one said. They had a singer's voice, high and clear. He started to wonder if it might have been better to have 7 different conversations with the prisoners rather than 1 with all of them. They were performing for each other now, each of them signaling their loyalty to the others. It made it more difficult to know what their actual flexibility might be. "We can debate the benefits of centralized government later," Singh replied. "For now, I have 1 offer to make, and only 1. When I leave this room, I'm going to ask that an appointed judge review the evidence from the bombing and find all 7 of you guilty of terrorist acts. You will then be taken to a public place and shot." "Not much of a fucking offer," the first man said, rubbing his bruised ribs. "While the judge reviews that evidence, I'm going to have you held in private cells. The first one of you to cooperate in our investigation of terrorist activity on this station lives." "Turn traitor to save our own necks?" the young one said. You don't know Belters at all.
I know humans. I know that staying alive and keeping one's family safe is not a trivial reward for valued service to the Empire. It is the only choice you have left in your lives. Make the right one.
Before they could shout any defiance at him, Singh turned and left. As they walked away, he said to Overstreet, "Put them in separate cells, far enough apart that they can't hear each other. Then make sure there's a guard outside every door, just in case someone decides to take me up on my offer."
"Copy that," Overstreet replied.
There was a hint of skepticism in his tone.
Singh stopped. Overstreet turned to face him, a puzzled look on his broad face.
"Something troubling you, Major?"
"I didn't intend any disrespect, sir. Our mandate from High Consul Duarte is to win over the population of this station, as a first step in winning over the population of the colony worlds. We do that by entangling our interests, by teaching them that what they think of as informing is actually just good citizenship. This is just a first step in building what will hopefully be a network of cooperators to help us."
"Understood," Overstreet said. "Marines make terrible police, sir. We're not trained for this sort of job. If we could build up a security force made up of local cooperators and marine elements, it would help a lot."
"Good. Make that part of your mandate going forward. You have full authority to offer amnesty to people you think might be useful."
"I'll pass it down the ranks," Overstreet said. He began gently pushing Singh back up the corridor toward their little convoy of carts.
"The other thing," Singh said, "I think it would be appropriate to make a complete audit of the security protocols. Call it a supplemental security review."
"I can do that if you like, sir," Overstreet said. "Can I ask what function the review would fill?"
He meant, "Am I being called on the carpet?" This was also the fallout of letting Tanaka go. There would be a period where his people trusted him less, suspected that he would blame them for failures in the system, punish them for things that weren't their fault.
"We need," he began, then caught himself, "I need to look over the complete system of security we have. Things are going to change simply because we are here, with these people, and not in a classroom at the academy. I don't know how yet, but I think it's inevitable. I'm trusting you to tell me not only what we do, but why, and whether you think it should be altered."
"Comprehensive, then," Overstreet said, but he sounded more pleased by the implied trust than put out by the extra work.
"I'll see to it. Back to the office, sir?"
Singh almost said yes, but a thought stopped him.
"No," Singh said. "No, take me to Carrie Fisk's office, and notify her we're coming."
On the ride to the Association of Worlds offices, Singh thought back to his letter home. The idea that being able to hold the ring space meant they'd won the war was optimistic. Or simplistic, at least. Laconia could absolutely control access to the worlds through the gates, but every single world could decide this didn't mean they were conquered. And even if they placed a Laconian governor on every world, and a Laconian naval ship in orbit, and marines patrolling the streets, every individual might decide they personally had not been conquered. Establishing the Empire was an endless series of microscopic magnifications into greater and greater granularity, and every grain was a potential renegade. Medina was just a microcosm of the problem they'd be running into everywhere. Political opposition considered as fractal geometry. He had been sent as a governor, and the more he saw, the more he came to understand what that assignment actually was. Not just a bureaucrat to oversee the smooth functioning of the station and the traffic it controlled. He was creating the template for making every other human world into a new Laconia. 7 Belters
had decided that killing a single low-level officer was worth risking all their own lives. That wasn't a rational position. An enemy that bad at basic math might do anything. The colony worlds might decide that throwing a few hundred people with rifles onto a transport ship and trying a suicide attack on Medina made sense. He only needed to hold the station for a few more weeks until the typhoon arrived and rendered any such foolhardy attack plan irrelevant. Kerry Fisk could help to carry the message that would dissuade any such error before it could happen. The office complex, occupied by the Association of Worlds, sat inside the drum section of Medina, surrounded by farmland. It consisted of three blocky structures of prefab fiberglass sheets, painted a gentle off-white and sporting the interlocking honeycomb banner of their organization. Singh suspected the design was intended to symbolize the interconnected rings of the gate network. For the headquarters of an organization whose goal was the centralized governance of 1,300 worlds, it looked cheap, shabby, and hastily erected. Nothing like the massive stone structures Laconia built to house the future government of mankind. Kerry Fisk occupied an office on the third floor of the largest of the three buildings. She had a lot of empty space, a single desk with four chairs, and flaking light green paint on her fiberglass walls. He wondered what their first meeting would have been like if he'd come to her office instead of bringing her to his. Seeing all of this, he might have recommended against working with her at all. "Madam President," Singh said as he entered, taking her hand in his own, "I'm glad you could take the time to meet with me on such short notice. This is Major Overstreet, the Marine Commander on Medina." Kerry shook his hand and gave Overstreet a baffled nod. "Of course, Governor. Any time," she said, and gestured to her chairs. Singh sat. Overstreet did not. "Tea?" Singh declined with a wave of his hand. "I'm afraid I don't have much time to socialize. I have an important message for you to send to the Association Worlds and to the local governments on those worlds that have at this point elected not to officially join you." "Okay," Kerry said. She really was a frightened little mouse of a person, Singh decided. He found himself wondering how such a person could become the leader of anything, much less the nascent government of a galaxy-spanning republic. But she'd had a following before he came, so maybe there was more to her than he saw. Failing that, she could be made into the sort of person he needed. "It occurs to me that while the heart of the Tempest is engaged with the fleets in the Sol system, and additional Laconian forces have not yet arrived to secure Medina Station, some ill-informed members of your association, or other prospective members who haven't officially joined you yet, might view this as a moment of weakness for our occupation." "I don't..." Kerry started. "But it's important that everyone understand that such a view is both inaccurate and dangerous," Singh continued over the top of her. "You will send a message, as the president of the new Laconian Congress of Worlds, to every planet in the network." "The what?" "The change of name will more closely join your group with the Empire. It's important that they recognize you as a legitimate and trusted representative of Laconia. You will tell them that any hostile action taken through one of the ring gates, be that a ship full of soldiers or an angrily thrown rock, will result in the total sterilization of the inhabited planet on the other side of that ring." Kerry went still for a moment. "Jesus Christ, are you serious?" "It's come to my attention that many of the social organizations of the old human power structures show a shocking inability to do risk analysis. They may foolishly attempt a doomed assault, thinking all they're risking is their own lives. Reason doesn't work with this kind of person. I need you to make them understand, on an emotional level, the price for such an attack. I will kill every single person on their planet. I assume even former OPA radicals have family members they care about, and whose lives they are less willing to risk on a romantic notion of a hero's death. Overstreet's bright blue eyes were on him. Singh felt the man evaluating him. "I can't be part of something like that," Carrie said. "You can," Singh insisted. "Because I'm making that the rule of engagement for our occupation here, whether you warn people or not. I think it's best if everyone understands that before they do anything with such a terrible price. Don't you agree?" Singh stood up, and Overstreet opened the door for him. Carrie Fisk stared at him from behind her desk. Singh didn't see the fear he expected on her face. More a sort of simple-minded confusion. "Please get the announcement out before the end of the day," he said. "I leave the wording to you, as long as all the details I laid out are included. Good day, Madam President." He left the room, with Fisk still reeling from the shock. Overstreet fell easily into stride behind him. "Permission, sir," Overstreet said, his tone reserved and formal, distant almost. Singh felt a moment's chagrin. He should have called Overstreet by his given name. He'd forgotten that, and it seemed late to change their habits now. He needed to be more careful about that. "Proceed, Major. Are we going to order those attacks?" "Only if we have to," Singh said. Overstreet didn't reply at once, and when he did, his tone was flat. "Understood," he said. Chapter 25. Holden. Holden shifted in his bunk. If he lay on his side with one arm raised and his head resting on it like a pillow, he could block that ear, then put a hand over the ear that was pointed up at the bunk above him. It was almost enough to block out Alex's snoring. But it also made his shoulder ache after a while, and his hand fell asleep before he did. He could track down a set of earplugs, but that meant getting out of bed. Half awake as he was, that seemed like a lot of trouble. Anyway, no one else in the bunk seemed to be bothered. He also knew, half knew, that if he woke up enough to fix the problem, he'd be too awake to sleep again. Admitting that age and anxiety had turned him into a light sleeper felt vaguely shameful in a way that probably wouldn't have stood the scrutiny of a fully conscious mind. Years of living with his crew had built habits and norms that they were violating in these new circumstances, and it was weird. Clarissa made an uncomfortable sound halfway between a whine and a growl. In the bunk across from him, Naomi shifted. By the dim orange glow of the safety light, he could just make out the curve of her shoulder, the shape of her hair spilling out over her pillow. Which meant his eyes were open. Which meant he was awake. He tried closing his eyes again, willing himself back down to sleep, but Alex coughed above him and Holden shifted his arm. The pins and needles started in his fingers. The last wisps of dream and oblivion thinned and vanished out of his brain. As quietly as he could, he rolled to the edge of the bunk, let himself down to the deck, and slipped out the door, leaving the others to get the rest he couldn't. The web of unmonitored space that Saba and his people had carved out of the flesh of the station was tighter than living on any ship holding it crewed. Keeping the power low enough to avoid detection meant thick air and rationed water. The murmur of voices speaking in musical belter creole was as present as the hum of the air recyclers. Holden made his way to the head, an emergency cut-in to the processing system with a seat about the right size for a 5-year-old. He had to wait for the woman already there to finish. By the time he stepped back into the access hall, he was fully awake, hungry, and a little grumpy. Naomi slouched down the hall toward him. Her undershirt was stained with sleep sweat and use. The top of her half-undone jumpsuit gathered at her hips like humanity's worst bustle. Her hair and face still had the shape of her pillow to them. She was beautiful. She made everything better than it would have been without her. "You're up," she said.
"I am.
Me too.
Sucks, right?"
"Oh, yeah," she said, then gestured toward the head. He shifted out of her way. "Want to risk breakfast out in the world?" she asked as she passed him. Holden let the question sit in his chest while he was alone in the corridor. When they were in the secret passageways of the underground, they were safe in that they were unmonitored. The Laconian-controlled station was dangerous, but it was also open. Fresh air, better food, and as far as Holden knew, they still weren't on security shit list. And there were things they could learn by being there that they'd never get if they only ever stayed where it was safe. When Naomi emerged, he took her arm like they were stepping out to a formal affair, and together they walked to one of the security hatches, and from there, into Medina Station. The transition points were the most dangerous. Moving from the unmonitored spaces into public without seeming to pop into existence out of nowhere meant timing their passage in places that were only intermittently watched, or else getting secondary entrances into showers, locker rooms, and toilets where privacy gave them cover. When they reached the open sections of the station, it was moving from one kind of oppressive environment into another. The halls were bright and open, the air fresh, and, if anything, a little cool. Screens and monitors showed the locally produced Laconia-approved news, propaganda about the stability and security of the station, mixed with whatever pop culture feeds from outside the slow zone made it past their sensors. Holden and Naomi walked through it like refugees at a shopping complex, trying not to blink into the two bright lights. They weren't alone. The crews of all the other ships and the citizens of the station all had the same dazed look to them, though at different intensities. People were still scrounging for quarters or camping on the inner face of the dome. The docks were still locked down, and that showed no sign of changing. Any normal hand terminals were still blocked from sending messages off Medina or gathering data that wasn't locally stored and vetted. There was a way that being in Saba's underground felt like being buried alive, and there was a way that being outside of it made being buried alive seem like not such a bad thing. It was cozy, anyway. They stopped at a cafe two levels below the open air of the drum's interior. He got a bulb of genuinely third-rate coffee, over-roasted to hide the shitty beans and the taste of the char, and a chalky cream substitute, and Naomi got tea and a corn muffin that they could split. They sat at a little table as far away from the public passage as they could get and still have a good view of the foot traffic passing by. Two men, smoking pipes that looked like they'd been made of decking ceramic. A group of schoolchildren in matching gray-green uniforms. A busker with a marionette trying to amuse passers-by with her antics. It could have been any station in human space. And as they watched, they talked about things that weren't dangerous if anyone were to overhear. In the public corridor, a security team walked past. Two figures in the blue power armor bristling with weapons. The carts and foot traffic moved around the pair like a stream flowing around rocks. Their presence wasn't intimidating people as much now, or at least not in the same ways. On a screen across the corridor, Kerry Fisk of the newly renamed Laconian Congress of Worlds was being interviewed by a pretty young man with a military haircut. Holden wondered what she was saying. But the cafe had their system set to a light, friendly Saidi list that shifted from one melody to the next without ever pausing in between. The same music, Holden guessed, that they'd played before Laconia came knocking. It was all becoming normal. He could see it in the way the clerk served up the terrible, terrible coffee. He could hear it in the conversations at the nearby tables. It showed on the screens and in the gates of the people walking by. Panic and alarm were exhausting. He was exhausted by them, and Medina was exhausted too. It was already shifting into its new routine. Checkpoints, yes. Armed security, yes. All the theater of dominance and control, and nothing to undercut that narrative. Just to look at it, you wouldn't guess there'd been a bombing. Saba hadn't known it was coming either, and they'd only heard about it through him. A small explosion, but the unofficial report said at least one Laconian had been killed. The official reports, apparently, were that it hadn't happened at all. That was a change. The assassination attempt had been used to justify the crackdown. Now the crackdown was just another day, and highlighting the attacks on the structures of power wasn't useful. Nothing had to be justified anymore. Governor Singh, in his offices, was trying to project a sense of normalcy and inevitability, and as far as Holden could tell, it was working. "Kind of quiet," he said, meaning, "they think they're winning." Naomi tugged her hair down over her eyes. "Right," she said. It meant, "I think they're winning, too." Back in the underground, Holden found Saba sitting at a dumb terminal. Even in full light, Saba's hair and skin were nearly the same color. In the backsplash from the screen, he almost seemed like a cartoon of himself. He nodded at Holden and shifted a few centimeters on his bench to give him room. Holden sat. "Checking on the storm dump?" Holden asked, nodding toward the screen. The log entries spooled up. The information they were intercepting from the Laconians was encrypted on a variety of levels and using more than one schema.
"Dui," Saba said. "Everything between the station and the storm is coming in, but until we get access to the server that decrypts it, it's just noise."
"Plenty more irons in that fire, though. Medina comms got more compromised than we thought. Turns out Golden Bow bought a tech 18 months ago. Got a back door into the system we never noticed."
"Really?" Holden said. "How'd you find it now?"
"Koyo told us," Saba said, flashing a grin. "Patriotism is weird shit."
Holden chuckled. "Whatever works, I guess."
They sat for a moment in near silence.
Saba scratched his arm and pointedly didn't look at Holden when he spoke again.
"Big Koya seems like she's got a little stone in her throat. Any trouble with your crew?"
"Nope," Holden said, and then, "I mean, yeah, but nothing that'll cause a problem."
"Don't guess you want to say what. Make me feel better to know."
Holden leaned forward. The logs spooled past. Storage filling with traffic that might be everything to them, or nothing. Bobby wasn't something he'd talked about before. He wasn't sure he wanted to start now, but he was living in Saba's rooms, eating the man's food, coordinating on his operations.
"It's not exactly my crew," Holden said. "I had some trouble with the union before all this happened."
Saba's grin came again.
"You're forgetting whose man I am, Keno. Drummer spends a little time talking about you behind your back, and that means to me."
"Right, so I was in the process of retiring when all this came down. Dropping off the freehold guy was my last mission. Was going to be. The crew is really Bobby's. Only then history got in the way, and now I'm sort of back in charge and sort of not.
It's awkward.
Sabi, Saba said.
I'm there too.
Something wrong between you and Bobby?
No, no, no. Only that Medina's my home port, but the Malaclips is my home. This came down and I got put at the front because of my spouse and her job and the union. Plenty enough around here don't like that. Do their own thing because it's their own.
Like the bombing, Holden said.
Like that trap, yeah. Like the trying for the governor. Like a bunch of assholes I stopped who were looking to steal Laconian uniforms, beat up some of our own so they could start shit between, yeah?
That doesn't seem productive, Holden said.
Not about productive, Saba said. About reaching for what can get done. Plenty of old OPA on Medina. When the Alliance turned into the Union, it didn't erase all the old factions.
There's Ochoa OPA, and there's Johnson OPA, even when there's no Ochoa or Johnson.
Voltaire Collective set that bomb like they'd just been waiting for the chance, and maybe they were. Oldsters going at it like they were young again. Young ones trying to live up to the stories of the bad old days, like pumping oxygen into a fire.
Holden shook his head.
If we're going to manage anything, we have to...
The dumb terminal chirped, and one of the entries came up highlighted.
Saba pulled the interface pad closer and scrolled back to the flagged entry. He cross-checked and opened the file. All the things a real system would have done for him automatically if they could risk using one.
Saba clicked his tongue against his teeth.
What have we got? Holden asked.
Traffic control plan update, Saba said. Got something slated as coming in through Laconia Gate, but not right away.
How far out?
42 days, Saba said. He moved through the data as carefully as he could, checking the distribution stamps and time codes. It didn't take him long to find the name and transit specs for the ship. The Typhoon. And from the mass and energy profile, it was huge. On a hunch, Holden had Saba match it with Laconia's first transit. The two were the same. The Typhoon was another tempest. Holden felt a tightness under his ribcage, wondering how many more like it there were.
Saba cursed under his breath.
A man's voice came from behind them, somewhere in the warren of hidden corridors. A woman answered. The bulkheads, the exposed conduits and industrial decking, the thick air and the darkness. All of it was just the same as it had been when Holden sat down, except that now it seemed fragile.
Another warship from Laconia, with more soldiers. The beginning of the permanent occupation. Not just the beginning of the end. The end.
Saba cracked his knuckles and smiled ruefully at Holden.
Well, he said, leaves me wishing I could tell Drummer and the Union. Kind of thing she'd want to know.
Yeah, Holden said, trying to gather his wits. There was more than a little of him jumping around behind his own eyes like a panicked monkey, but this wasn't the time for it.
All right, we still have some time. Whatever we decide to do, our obstacles are the gathering storm outside the station and something like 200, maybe 250 power armor-wearing marines inside it.
And loose cannon OPA factions firing off without warning, Saba said.
When they hear about this, they'll get worse.
Complicate everything if they won't coordinate.
So, that too, Holden agreed. His brain felt like it was stuffed with cotton ticking. He wanted to get all his people onto the Rosinante and run away. If there was any place that the Laconians wouldn't just follow them and shoot them down, if there was any place in 1300 systems that would be safe anymore, for them or for anyone.
Okay, he said. All right. Whatever goals we decide on, we have to take those three things into account.
and we have to do it in the next 42 days.
Because after that, Saba said, no more us.
Yeah? Chapter 26.